Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. Today is August the 28th, 2019. Oh my, next week it's Labor Day. Where did the summer go? I'm Hank Key and my colleague is Joe King. Do you know who has your personal data? Do you know how Facebook, Google, and Amazon and the other big tech companies are using your personal data? Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time, PRN.FM, streaming on the Internet. Podcasts of the program is available on PRN.FM on the Internet and PCRadioshow.org. To listen to the live program on the telephone each Wednesday at 6 p.m., the number is 641-793-7091. You can leave me a message if you have any questions or comments at hank@pcradioshow.org. What's thumbs up and thumbs down with the upcoming Labor Day computer sales? I haven't organized this in any format yet, but I wanted to get this out since Labor Day promotional sales are hitting the market. If you're interested in buying a Chromebook, buy only a new unit. As we reported, the product lifecycle of the Chromebook for security support is 6.5 years. However, it's not from the date of purchase, from the date of manufacture. And if you were to buy a used or refurbished or discontinued unit, you will be buying a system with security support shortened. Do not buy a Chromebook because the pundits, you know what I call those journalists out there, tell you that the Chromebook is secure from viruses and malware. If that was so, why the necessary security support during the supported product lifecycle? Windows 10 notebooks that have 32GB or 64GB of memory card storage are not cost-effective. These units are not memory nor mass storage upgradable. It is possible to upgrade Windows 10 with these sub-Windows units, but you need to be knowledgeable enough to know how to reallocate parts of the operating system onto an SD or micro SD card for storage. Before buying a personal computer, download the maintenance manual if it is available. Read through it to determine the degree of complexity to upgrade memory or mass storage. During the life of the computer, the upgrade of these two component parts will enable you to lengthen the useful life of the product. If you are using the computer to meet an immediate need for mission-critical activities, such as doing term or thesis paper, small business operation, or financial activities, buy what is available at the given market price. Don't wait for a sale to buy replacement equipment for mission-critical work. For me, do not buy a refurbished or used system from a computer outlet. If the price is right, buy it directly from the manufacturer. You want some degree of assurance that original equipment manufacturer parts are in the system. Some dealers assemble a working computer from third-party parts and from parts that might have been discarded. One of the present problems are battery replacement. Many of the notebook batteries do not meet specification. When you complain, they tell you to keep what was sent to you, and they'll send you another battery. With used or refurbished equipment, the original battery may be out of production, and you do have to settle for a third-party unit. Perhaps maybe in that case, you just buy a new system. Remember, when you buy a printer, be it an inkjet or a laser printer, the supplied ink that came with the purchase will only print a few pages, so make sure you buy toner or cartridge after you make the purchase. Another spec you need to know is the duty cycle of the printer. The duty cycle is how many pages you can print each day without degrading the product life of the printer. Also, you should review the cost of the print. And if it's a multifunction unit that you're thinking of buying, most no longer have the fax option. If you're buying a replacement computer system unit and you plan to reconnect some existing peripherals to it, make certain that there are available software-supported drivers. Before making a computer purchase, you need to know what and how many connectors are on the system. You want at minimum at least two USB ports, preferably one which is USB 3.0 for new equipment, and the other one is a USB 2.0 for older equipment. Not all 15-inch display notebooks have a numeric keypad, if that's a requirement. Not all notebooks have an Ethernet port. Not all desktop systems have the wireless COM port. Not all notebooks have the ability to use a replaceable battery. Not all notebooks and desktops have optical media, such as a DVD or CD reader and burner. Identify what features are nice to have and what features are deal breakers if it's not available. Just remember that you have to earn $2 for every $1 you want to spend. When in doubt, if it's not mission critical, defer the purchase and wait for another day. Black Friday and Cyber Monday is not too far away, and sales in the computer business is ongoing. The Internal Revenue Service issued a warning to alert taxpayers and tax professionals of an active IRS impersonation scam campaign, sending spam emails to deliver malicious payloads. This warning was issued after the IRS received several reports from taxpayers regarding unsolicited messages with automatic income tax reminder or electronic tax return reminder subjects coming from scammers impersonating the U.S. Revenue Service with the help of spoofed email addresses. The emails have linked that shows an IRS government-like website with details pretending to be about the taxpayer's refund, electronic return, or tax account. The emails contain a temporary password or one-time password to access the files to submit the refund, but when taxpayers try to access these, it turns out to be a malicious file. More to the point, after entering the password issued in the spam message, the targets would unintentionally download malware that could allow the malicious actors to either harvest sensitive info or take control of the victim's compromised systems. This new scam uses dozens of compromised websites and web addresses that pose as IRS.gov, making it a challenge to shut down. By infecting computers with malware, these imposters may gain control of the taxpayer's computer or secretly download software that tracks every keystroke, eventually giving them passwords to sensitive accounts, such as financial accounts. The IRS does not send emails about your tax refund or sensitive financial information. This latest scheme is yet another reminder that tax scams are a year-round business for thieves. The IRS urges you to be on guard at all times. The U.S. Cybersecurity and Infrastructure Security Agency, CISA, also urges users and administrators to review the CISA tip on how to avoid phishing and social engineering attacks. This warning comes after the IRS issued a joint news release with the U.S. tax industry and state tax agencies in late July to remind professionals and taxpayers that they are required by federal law to have a data security plan in place. This IRS alert can help both tax pros and taxpayers to combat attacks designed to steal sensitive info, such as attack campaigns that are targeting the tax season using realistic phishing emails containing malicious attachments. In 2018, tax pros were targeted by a mouse spam campaign also distributing emails pretending to come from the IRS, which allows threat actors to infect their targets' computers with a rapid ransomware variant. Back in 2017, the IRS issued another warning regarding a phishing attack posing as official IRS communications and attempting to lure targets into clicking a link or downloading malicious file, which would infect them with ransomware. Attackers also used phone scams as observed in 2016 to pose as IRS and to ask potential victims to extinguish outstanding debts of thousands of dollars via gift card payments. A press release from Verizon Wireless on the retirement of their CDMA network. The following reads, "As we complete our network transition to 4G and 5G, we at Verizon would like to keep you up to date with some important activities. We are moving all our devices to our HD Voice LTE network, which offers superior coverage and performance compared to previous generation networks. Starting January 1, 2020, Verizon will no longer allow any CDMA like-for-like device changes. The editorial comment on that is you will not be able to switch your old CDMA cell phone for a newer model CDMA cell phone, starting January 1, 2020. Then they continue with transfer of service, moving from one account to another account. Bring your own device. We are moving all devices to our HD voice LTE network. The Verizon CDMA network will remain available as is until the end of 2020. 3G only devices, including 3G basic phones and 3G smartphones, 4G LTE smartphones, service will discontinue completely the end of the year. The editorial comment is there will no longer be CDMA service at the end of 2020. Verizon has confirmed that it will no longer activate 3G only phones on its CDMA network ahead of a 2019 shutdown as the telecom migrates nearly all of its traffic over to its 4G LTE network. For several years, you've been publicly told that the 3G CDMA network will remain available through the end of 2019. AT&T uses GSM technology just like T-Mobile, Verizon, and Sprint. On the other hand, CDMA, which stands for Code Division Multiple Access, all it means is that Verizon can pile on several people to use its network at once. Verizon already has GSM as its base network. As of January 1, 2020, CDMA is no longer going to be supported or even function on Verizon network. If you have a CDMA-only device now, start saving up for a new phone because it's going to stop working after next year. Most of the rest of the world uses GSM. The global spread of GSM came about because of 1987. Europe mandated the technology by law, and because GSM comes from an industry consortium. Which is technically better, GSM or CDMA? Not that it matters at this point. This is like asking which was technically better, VHS or Beta. GSM stands for Global System for Mobile Communications, and unless you live in the United States or Russia, this is probably the technology your phone network uses, given it's the standard system for most of the world. GSM network uses TDMA, which stands for Time Division Multiple Access. TDMA works by assigning time slots to multiple conversation streams, alternating them in sequence and switching between each conversation in very short intervals. During these intervals, phones can transmit the information, and in order for the network to know which users are connected to the network, each phone uses a subscriber identification module card, otherwise known as SIM card, S-I-M, SIM card. SIM cards are one of the key features of the GMSA networks. They house your service subscription, network identification, and address book information. The cards are also assigned to time slots to the phone conversation, and moreover, they tell the network what services you have access to. They store your address book too, along with relative contact information. They can even be used to pass information between phones if a carrier allows it. CDMA, on the other hand, stands for Code Division Multiple Access. It's often found in the United States and Russia, though GSM is also present in those countries. The Allied forces developed a technology during World War II primarily as a method to prevent Nazi forces from jamming radio signals. Unlike GSM, CDMA grants users full access to the entire spectrum of bands, thus allowing more users to connect at any given time. It also encodes each user's individual conversation via a pseudo-randomized digital sequence, meaning the voice data remains protected and filtered so that only those participating in the phone call receives the data. Phones on CDMA networks do not use SIM cards. Instead, each phone is built specifically to work on that carrier's network, or at least it used to be. What does this mean for consumers? For starters, it meant that phones were tied to a carrier and their bands. So if you decide to change providers, you have to buy a new phone. That's not always the case anymore because network technology has moved on and CDMA carriers do tend to use SIM cards in their phones now, but they're for LTE. Which is better? It is academic at this point. GSM is the standard, and if you have an old cell phone and you haven't gotten a new model because all you needed the phone was just to make a phone call, you don't need all the other Swiss knife functions added to the cell phone. But time marches on and CDMA will disappear. Time to get a new phone if you're now using CDMA. The following is a sidebar to the discussion on GSM versus CDMA. Spread spectrum communication systems are often used when there is a need for message security and confidentiality, and where there is a requirement that the message be received error-free. A spread spectrum system is able to offer a very high degree of message security in a number of ways, depending on the system implementation. Such a system may spread the data over a very wide bandwidth, making it almost impossible for a narrow band receiver to decipher any useful information. Along a similar vein, the same system may be able to operate at a very high degree of interference rejection, both from intentional as well as unintentional sources. Spreading the data across the frequency spectrum makes the signal resistant to noise, interference, and eavesdropping. Spread spectrum modulation schemes are commonly used with personal communication devices such as digital cellular phones, as well as with wireless local area networks. Who invented spread spectrum? Spread spectrum technology was co-invented by a very famous actress in the 1940s, Hedy Lamarr, during World War II, to help direct American torpedoes and prevent them from getting jammed and sent off course. Hedy Lamarr and her ranger invented the frequency hopping concept. Since Lamarr didn't use her stage name on the patent, it took years for the story of the patent to surface. It never made her any money. Although better known for her silver screen exploits, Austrian actress Hedy Lamarr, born Hedwig Eva Maria Keisler, also became a pioneer in the field of wireless communications following her emigration to the United States. Yet apart from being a Hollywood icon, Hedy Lamarr had a varied and interesting life and was an accomplished scientific inventor. With co-inventor George Antheil, she invented a radio system for preventing jamming using a system known as frequency hopping. This is in widespread use today. After a start in cinema at the age of 19, she married Fritz Mandl, a rich Austrian weapons manufacturer who worked with the Nazis. This marriage didn't last. To escape, she set sail for America in 1937, meeting Metro-Goldwyn-Mayer co-founder Louis B. Mayer on the boat. He cast her in his movies, often in the role of seductress, and changed her name to Hedy Lamarr. At a friend's home, Lamarr met pianist and composer George Antheil, who shared her passion for inventing. That was 1940, a few years before the U.S. joined World War II. Lamarr and Antheil were determined to help defend against German attacks. Inspired by a piano roll, perforated paper that controls player pianos, Lamarr and Antheil developed a device that would guide torpedoes to their targets using a radio signal that hopped among 88 frequencies. The constant change, they figure, would prevent enemies from locking on to the torpedo. The pair were granted U.S. patent number 2292387 for their technology in 1942, but the military didn't take the system's movie star co-inventor seriously. She and Antheil didn't see a dime, even though the military later used their technology, as did the world, in cell phones, Bluetooth, and other wireless communications. You don't necessarily have to pay the ransom. Europost celebrated the third anniversary of its No More Ransom initiative, announcing that the public-private partnership had helped more than 200,000 ransomware victims recover their files using its library of freely available online tools instead of giving in to hackers' demands to pay a cryptocurrency ransom. All told, the recovered files saved victims some $108 million in ransom, according to Europol, the European Union police agency. The No More Ransom tools are available to everyone, not just those in the European Union. People from 188 countries have visited the project's website in 3 years, with nearly 10% of that traffic coming from the United States. That's according to data collected by the European Cybercrime Center. But here in the United States, where ransomware is on the rise and increasingly targeting both local governments and private companies, law enforcement has been strangely quiet about promoting alternatives to ransom payment. Lack of public awareness may be one reason that victims of ransomware in the United States are often willing to pay their attackers in order to regain control of their files and computer systems. But every time a victim pays hundreds of thousands of dollars to a cyber criminal, the payment reinforces the criminal's faith in their business model. For this reason, it is essential that victims stop paying these ransoms. Making ransomware unprofitable is effectively the only way, short of coordinated global regulation of cryptocurrencies, to stop these criminals. The FBI has struggled to send a clear message to ransomware victims ever since 2015, when an agent told the audience at a computer security conference in Boston, "We often advise people just to pay the ransom." The FBI later corrected its position that victims should not pay ransoms. The FBI doesn't support paying a ransom in response to a ransomware attack, the website states, adding that paying a ransom does not guarantee victims will get their files back and may serve to fund other criminal activity. But most of what the FBI recommends are preventive measures, such as patching software or backing up data, which is good advice. But it won't help victims whose computers have already been infected by ransomware. But ransomware victims who don't have offline backups of their data do have options. Many common strains of ransomware have, in fact, been reverse engineered by software engineers and security firms that provide decryption tools. These tools won't work for every victim, but there are more than 100 decryption tools, each targeting a specific strain of ransomware, available free on the No More Ransom site. As a victim, of course, you may not be sure whether you've been infected with which strain of ransomware, but if you upload any of the encrypted files created by the ransomware on your computer, No More Ransom will let you know if it has any tools that can help. In order for these tools to be effective, victims have to know where to find them in the first place. And so far, American law enforcement has done much less than its European counterparts to publicize the existence of these options. If the victims had sought advice exclusively from the United States law enforcement agencies like the FBI, the Department of Homeland Security Computer Emergency Readiness Team, or the Secret Service, they certainly would not have decrypted any infected files, such as the website ID Ransomware, created to help victims identify the ransomware they are facing. Contrast that with Europol, which has partnered with private companies, researching and building decryption tools to combat ransomware. It promotes the No More Ransom tools on its website and encourages their use by victims who might otherwise be reluctant to trust a strange website at a moment when they are feeling particularly gullible and vulnerable. This silence on the part of the American government is baffling. The recommendation these agencies offer about creating regular backups and not clicking on suspicious email attachments are valid and useful prevention tips, but none of them help the thousands of people who are most likely to be looking at their websites, the people whose hard drives are already infected and encrypted. The FBI should get involved and partner with its counterparts in Europe and around the world to create and promote trustworthy resources for ransomware victims who want to do their part to stop ransomware by cutting into cyber criminal profits. And as I have stated, if you have backup, that's the first step in overcoming any ransomware if it does affect you. Backup your data regularly. Most appreciate only backup after they have lost data and they did not have backup to begin with. Presenting Benjamin Rockwell with his IT Pro Series, Business versus Consumer Personal Computers.
It's time to get down to business. This is Benjamin Rockwell, and this is where I'm going to give you some tidbits from my experience of being an IT professional for decades. One of the big, huge things that I hear people talk about all the time is, there's no difference between business PCs and consumer PCs. There's no real reason for a business to spend extra for the business PCs. And you know what? You can all just buy the cheapest. And the reality is, no, there are differences. Business-grade computers are built differently than the consumer-grade computers. I've actually seen this in effect on a number of different lines from a number of different manufacturers. We see certain things that are happening over and over again, and these different nuances will drive what kind of computer you are going to wind up with in the end. Yes, a business could save a few hundred dollars here and there by buying a bunch of consumer-grade PCs, but they're going to pay for it in the long run. They're going to wind up paying extra in the amount of support, the amount of work that's going to have to go into the end of life of those computers. And usually that's where I see a lot of a problem because, okay, we're going to buy these desktops that are a few hundred dollars. And then, yeah, we're going to make our IT guy just spend all kinds of time just supporting that $200, $300, $400 computer and trying to keep it up and running. And oh yeah, it failed. So what happened to all of our data? Yeah, this happens all the time. So let's dive in. First off, you do want to select a business PC, a business computer, if you are using it for business purposes. There are a few different things that are going on here. For instance, if you are telecommuting a lot, you've got a small office, home office, you want that computer to be reliable day in, day out. You want that computer to be running at its peak performance for as long as possible. Now, computers that are sold to consumers, especially the lower end ones, they're going to shave a few corners. They're going to make sure that it's still going to run Windows, although it's going to run the home edition versus the professional edition. It's going to have certain things that are reduced in their power, reduced in how they operate versus, yeah, business PC is going to have different strengths added to it. All right, so one of the areas which is really key and really big that we need to focus on is, all right, a consumer PC might be into playing games. We have a different type of video card, a video arrangement that we utilize whenever we're dealing with video games, especially in the PC world. It's going to be a different type of video card, a different power of video card than is going to be utilized for somebody who's just dealing with Excel spreadsheets. So there is a little bit more money that's spent initially on some of those consumer PCs towards that video arrangement, but it's a different type of money, especially since we also get in back over into those business PCs, and we know you're going to be dealing with some of the professional items, the higher end items, such as CAD, such as presentations, doing some kind of video editing, and a number of other business services that happen over there. Then all of a sudden we shift to a higher end video card. But it's a different video card. The hard drives are also going to be a different type of hard drive. Hard drives are not just, oh yeah, it's all about size. No, there are differences in how these hard drives are built. Some of them are built better for reading information. Some of them are built better for writing information. Some of them are built to handle a lot more heat, such as, yes, in an office environment where they're on for 8 hours a day straight every day, minimum of 8 hours. You know, you figure in, okay, so you're going to go to lunch and then there's always you're staying late or you're getting in early. So it's got to handle more like 10, 11, 12 hours. Oh, yeah. And in many companies, you leave the computer on all the time. So it has to handle a different kind of heat arrangement. Now, yes, consumer PCs have some level of durability to them, but it's lesser. They no longer need to worry about, okay, is this going to be utilized as a high-end computer on all the time? No, they don't care about that. They care about shaving little bits and pieces and dollars down to the low end. we also get into that business arrangement where the companies that are making business-related PCs, they're looking for that long-term relationship. They're looking to make something that is going to be durable, that you're not going to have any kinds of issues with. As far as a business, if a business gets a bunch of, I'm going to just say XYZ computer systems, and it gets all of these systems out there, and all of a sudden, a year later, they're all failing, and it's under warranty, yes, it may still be paid for. It may still be just fine. However, yes, there is a certain level of attention, negative attention, that comes from the business where they say, what exactly did we buy? So, yeah, we go down the line, and there are going to be minor differences and major differences. Most of it has to deal with the power. Some of it has to deal with what version of Windows is going on. Most importantly, the warranty that's available and also the technical support. If I buy a business PC, yes, I'm getting business level support. I call up and yeah, I may even get an exclusive line which gets me to a live person here in the States immediately versus the consumer experience which some of you may have experienced. This is Benjamin Rockwell. Back to you, Hank.
Thank you, Benjamin. Why cashier's checks are part of so many online scams? Cashier's checks are being used in a growing number of schemes, says the Federal Trade Commission's Bureau of Consumer Protection. These scams are common on the online marketplace, and the number of fake checks complaints to the FTC and the Internet Fraud Complaint Center doubled between 2014 and 2017 from 12,781 to 29,513, according to a report by the Better Business Bureau. Technological changes had happened over the past 10 years that made cashier's checks easier for scammers to manufacture. Printers became cheaper, ink became easier to replicate, and a few federal laws are responsible for failing to contain the potentially disastrous mess of our online world. The number of fake checks complaints doubled between 2014 and 2017. In August of 1987, Congress voted the Expedited Funds Availability Act into effect. This regulation requires that banks give customers their money from cash checks after a certain amount of time. For most cash checks these days, this means funds must be available within 24 hours. In effect, this act is a compromise between security and convenience and gives banks less than a day to verify a check, and banks are also obligated to put most checks through a weeks-long clearing process. Together, these rules put banks in a double bind. They have to get customers the money before they verify the checks. Cashier's checks have particularly fast turnaround because they're supposed to be safe. They're guaranteed by a bank. They are the debit cards of the check world. When someone orders a legitimate cashier's check from a bank, they must either pay the full value in cash or have the amount available to be immediately withdrawn from their bank account. Because it's been paid for upfront, it's impossible for a cashier's check to bounce. It's a great currency for people who know each other but don't trust each other that much, like landlords and tenants. Cashier's checks are not great for people who don't know each other at all. That's because there's always a possibility that they are fake. Usually, the scammer gives the victim a check for more than they asked for and then asks them to pay the extra money to an apparent third party. And they normally have a plausible story for this part. There are several versions of this scam. Maybe a letter comes telling someone they've won the lottery but need to pay taxes in order to get their money. Perhaps someone hires a victim as a secret shopper, then asks them to use their own funds to confirm the reliability of the money transfer services. The people who design these scams are professionals, and they are experts at coming up with stories that catch people off guard or garner their sympathies. For example, U.S. financial institutions are on track to spend more than $68 billion on cybersecurity between 2016 and 2020. The key moment happens when a person cashes the fake check. The bank should catch it, right? That is, after all, its purpose. U.S. financial institutions are on track to spend more than $68 billion on cybersecurity between 2016 and 2020, according to a meta-study by the Department of Homeland Security. Banks use a combination of methods in order to secure checks. Mitek Systems, the company that creates the technology that banking apps use for mobile check deposits, explains that most big bank checks are printed by two companies, Harlan Clark and Deluxe. These businesses communicate frequently with their banks and technology companies like Mitek. Mitek has more than 40 patents in image processing technology, and they're going down to the pixel level. They said that tricks like the checkbox that says for mobile deposit only are particularly helpful. Banking apps take less than 3 seconds to visually analyze the checks. They give all the information they find over to the banks, which then puts the check through another round of security. If the cashier's check was written by a bank, it has to go through a clearinghouse, which is usually operated by the Federal Reserve Board. Even though this system has been largely automated since 2004, it can still take more than 2 weeks, according to the Better Business Bureau. That means there's often a gap between when the money goes to the bank customer and the moment it can actually be verified. Cashier's check scammers take advantage of this uncertainty by asking their victims to somehow return them some money. When the bank finally finds out the check is fake and takes the money from the customer's account, the con artist will have disappeared and the victim will be in the red. To the bank's credits, their security systems do actually catch a majority of fake checks. This is where the internet comes in. There are just so many of them. There were about $8 billion worth of check frauds in 2016, which cost the bank $790 million. From the bank's point of view, that's only 9%. But the web is great at linking potential scammers to lots of other people. So it's 9% of a huge number of people. That's a lot more opportunities for people to network and a lot more people to connect. The group most likely to be victims are people in their 20s, followed by small businesses, lawyers, and banks themselves. And this is according to a report by the Better Business Bureau. Lawyers have been targeted for the past few years. It has become so prolific and so common. Congress has tried to make check cashing more up to date. On October 28, 2003, they signed the Check Clearing Act for the 21st Century Act into law. It was supposed to help banks handle electronic checks more efficiently and allow the kinds of check deposit technology that Mitek system provides. However, it hasn't eliminated the gap between when a bank customer gets the funds from a cashier's check and when the bank verifies the check is real. People who have been defrauded are urged to report their experiences to the FTC. If a consumer is concerned about a particular actor, complain either to the Federal Trade Commission or the U.S. Postal Service. Microsoft says that Bluetooth speakers will stop connecting to devices running Windows 10 version 1903 after installing the patch cumulative update released on July 26th of this year. Besides the Bluetooth speakers no longer working properly, users will also notice a Microsoft Bluetooth source entry under the Sound Video and Game Controllers node displaying a yellow exclamation mark icon in Device Manager. This hints at the device being impacted by some issues related to either missing drivers or the driver not being installed correctly. After this patch, which is KB450-5903, I'll repeat that again, KB450-5903 is installed on a Windows computer with an internal speaker installed, users will experience one of the following issues. A Bluetooth speaker can't connect to the computer, or a Bluetooth speaker can connect to the computer, however, the speaker output sounds noisy, in other words, bad quality in sound. Or a Bluetooth speaker can connect to the computer, however, the sound is generated by the internal speaker instead of the Bluetooth device. Microsoft also provides a workaround for fixing this problem, which involves using the System File Checker, which is sfc.exe, tool to repair corrupted or missing system files. To do this, users with the affected systems have to follow these steps. open the command console by using the administrative authority, and at the command prompt, typed in the following, SFC space forward slash scan now. That's SCANNOW. Note, it may take several minutes for the command operation to be completed. After the process is finished, restart the computer. Superman was a comic strip character created in Cleveland a long time ago. He had some special visual skills that have long intrigued people, like X-ray vision. If this fictional character was real, how might that enhanced vision relate to today's technology? Marty?
It was more than 80 years ago when the Superman character debuted in Action Comics issue number 1. He was strong. He was fast. But there was no mention of anything special about his ability to see. That came later. As did I. But I only recently managed to waste some time thinking about all the ways special kinds of vision manifested themselves in the character. And I even came up with a plausible theory about how those special ways to see could exist on a scientific basis once we accept other things about the character. For now, though, let's think about the era of that 1939 debut. Newspapers had for some time been able to run photographs using either woodcuts or, more commonly, dot screens. If you're old enough to remember early newspaper photos, they reproduced the original images as arrays of black dots of various sizes printed on white newsprint paper. Glossy magazines were also largely running black and white photography, but creating them with a much finer screen so the dots were less obvious. That made sense. It was an era when black and white photography prevailed. Early movies were in black and white, too. Color, of course, soon followed in photography, in magazines, in movies, and more. When television arrived, it was entirely in black and white at first. Color came later. Human beings have always enjoyed sharing images with as much life to them as technology would allow. Some cave paintings had colors. Art paintings had colors. We could see the world in color, not just in black and white, but our technology was growing. It grew to allow us more detail. TV went to HD, and since then to 4K and beyond. We already have the technological ability to produce images that can display more detail than we can perceive by looking. But because we can't see the difference, those extreme resolutions only associate with very specialized applications. Consider the point of view of each of these technologies. To a black and white camera, the ability to see in color is a superpower. One more trip to the past. The Superman character was created in an era before zoom lenses. Back then, even movie cameras had only lens turrets. You might switch from one lens to another to view something more telescopically or more wide angle, but you would have to switch from one lens to another to do that. Those were single-purpose optics. The zoom lens changed that. A single lens could change the geometry of its optics to work in multiple roles. The canon of the Superman character tells us he was born on a distant and very different planet, and that the environment on Earth and the brighter light of our sun are the sources of many of the hallmark differences between him and ordinary mortal men. I think we can stipulate that he is an alien in human form who has the immediate availability of enormous amounts of energy and enormous resiliency. In other words, he's built differently. So what does that have to do with what he sees? For Terran humans, those of us from Earth, normal vision starts with deep red, just above the infrared, and extends to deep violet, just before ultraviolet. And what we see is the spectrum in between. I imagine that Superman's vision extends well beyond these boundaries. I believe his vision extends well into the long-wave infrared band, like the sensitivity of a heat imager. It may even extend down into microwave or radio wave sections of the spectrum. I believe his vision extends across the ultraviolet, across the short X-ray wavelengths, even into shorter wave parts of the spectrum, perhaps even to particle energy wavelengths. That would make, for example, cosmic radiation something his vision could perceive. That extraordinarily wide-band perception starts to explain, at least to my imagination, some of the visual feats that are associated with him. X-ray vision, for example, may have nothing at all to do with X-rays. It might turn out to use techniques similar to the RF backscatter imagers that you can buy today to see pipes within walls, for example. Those imagers use the ever-present radio waves that exist everywhere these days and recognize differences in their signal strength on your side of a wall as differences in brightness in their images. Ground-penetrating radar is similar, though it produces its own signals. The extended range of sensitivity that I suggested for Superman's eyes would, similarly, allow his brain to process what his eyes see as real-time 3D images of things behind or within other things. And in the comics, that's called X-ray vision. In the movies and the TV shows, X-ray vision. Before you ask, I have no idea why lead would block that. Remember the camera turret where you could switch from one lens to another versus the zoom lens that could assume multiple roles by altering the geometry of its optics? Superman has been reported as having telescopic vision, microscopic vision, and so-called normal vision. But there's nothing to suggest a turret-like switching among modes. Instead, I'll postulate that musculature around his eyes, super-powered musculature, can squeeze their optical geometry into telescopic focus or extreme macro-microscopic focus or anything in between. I see it as a focus-at-will adaptation made possible by the power and resilience of his alien biology. There's one more thing about Superman's eyes, with a name that's described as being a form of vision, but as I imagine it, really isn't. That's his heat vision, those laser-like power beams that seem to emit from his eyes. One clue for my interpretation is that using heat vision does not seem to temporarily blind him. Here's what I think might be happening. We have a being of extraordinary strength and power. In the early days of his people, in something akin to their cave-dwelling era, it's fair to assume they had to face dangers that they could only survive by discouraging an attacking beast. So, like the sting of a bee or the quill of a porcupine, there might have been some gland that could emit heat from somewhere in their head, enough heat to sting, hurt, and discourage a predator. In that primitive time, the more intense that heat, the better its aim and its focus and its range, the better the chances of survival. Natural selection kicks in, and evolution favors those who could better ward off predators. Over time, that might lead to the organic development of a conduit for this heat stinger. The eye socket seems a reasonable outlet port since it already breaches the skull. And we might expect that this would also allow the direction of the sting to track where the eye points. That would be consistent with a need to control aiming. Over time, the eyeball itself might develop layers that allow the flow of the heat without damage to either the eye or the brain. Bring that ahead to now from ancient Krypton, that's the name of Superman's home planet in related storytelling, bring that forward to the very advanced civilization that eventually perished when the planet met its end. What happens to that ancient defensive stinger in the context of a transformed man who now possesses control over enormous amounts of energy, as evidenced by his other powers? That, I believe, is a plausible explanation of what the Superman stories call his heat vision. At least in terms of the fiction, I'll guess the factual basis was more along the lines of a writer or artist or editor saying, let's give him laser beam eyes. Either way, heat vision is the one ability labeled as vision that really doesn't have very much to do with what or how Superman sees. The rest of it, at least in my imagination, is the natural result of combining what for him and his people would be a natural ability to perceive an energy spectrum that extends far beyond our own, in combination with a musculature that affords an ability to reshape the lens optics of the eye. Maybe that's why, in the old George Reeves TV series, Clark Kent's glasses never had any lenses in them. Glass would block part of that broader spectrum, limiting him to seeing just the wavelengths that could pass through glass. In other words, he's essentially seeing just what we see. Next time, while a lot of people sort of kind of understand relative humidity, a lot fewer people understand its kissing cousin, the dew point. The dew point is what weather professionals peg as the best indicator of when you're comfortable and when you're not. I'll do what I can to simplify things because whatever the relative humidity may be, I'll do my best to make understanding how it's relative to the dew point no sweat.
Thank you, Marty. By the way, Lois Lane wants to know what kryptonite nugget of thought you might have for next week. Public service announcements of computer club meetings in the New York, New Jersey, and Connecticut tri-state region. The computer clubs have random access sessions at each of these club meetings. If you have any questions or need for technical advice, the club members are more than happy to assist. There is no such thing as a dumb question. All these computer club meetings are open and free to the public. The Brookdale Computer Users Group will have a presentation on the future of Windows, Thursday, August the 29th. Meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet in the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road in Middletown, New Jersey. Danbury Area Computer Society will be meeting Tuesday, September the 3rd. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hackerspace, 158 Main Street in Danbury, Connecticut. Westchester PC Users Group meet Thursday, September the 5th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Keller Williams Realty, 120 Bloomingdale Road in White Plains, New York. The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey meets Friday, September the 6th. Meeting time is 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, 1916 Bartle Avenue, Scotch Plains, New Jersey. The Computer Learning Center at Ewing meets Tuesday, September the 10th. The meeting time is 2 p.m. at the Ewing Senior and Community Center, located at 999 Lower Ferry Road in Ewing, New Jersey. New York Amateur Computer Club has a meeting on iOS iPhone versus the Android phones. Meeting time is Thursday, September the 12th, and the meeting starts at 7 p.m. They meet at NYU Silver Building, 32 Waverly Place, room 414 in Manhattan, New York. Long Island Macintosh Users Group meet Friday, September the 13th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., and they meet at the Harry J. Scherr Hall, New York Institute of Technology, Old Westbury Campus out in Old Westbury, New York. We hope to see you at one of these meetings, and if you have a computer club meeting that you want me to announce on the air, send me a note. My address is hank@pcradioshow.org. Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm, streaming on the internet. Podcasts of the program is available on prn.fm, on the internet, and pcradioshow.org. If you have any questions for me, just send me an email addressed to hank@pcradioshow.org. There is no such thing as a stupid question. In the meantime, stay in touch and remember to do regular backups. I'm Hank Key, and on behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.